This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, the local news industry continues to shrink with industry layoffs and newspapers shutting down altogether. We'll talk to one of the organizers of a new coalition that aims to revitalize local journalism. But now, the Biden administration announced yesterday that it will end the COVID-19 public health emergency on May 11th. Some Republicans are saying that an end to the public health emergency needs to happen now in an effort to save taxpayer dollars. The Biden administration disagrees, saying it's important for healthcare workers to have time to prepare for what will inevitably change COVID policies and reactions to this deadly virus. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. What about declaring an end to this public health emergency? Have your own reactions or opinions toward COVID changed since 2020, if at all? And if you're a healthcare worker, we'd love to hear your perspective this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much, Lee. It's a pleasure joining you this afternoon.
Yeah, the White House said yesterday that the end of the public health emergency coming up in May is a sign that federal officials believe the pandemic has moved on to a new, less dire phase. While the New York Times reports that more than 500 people a day in the U.S. are still dying from COVID-19. What does the end of the public health emergency mean in terms of public health?
Well, I think it's the realization that we have gotten through the worst of this, even though it's going to continue at a low level for quite some time. I think as of today, we've had about 1.1 million people in this country die of COVID, which is huge. That's basically one out of every 300 people in this country. On the other hand, we are seeing the signs of the transition from the pandemic to much more of an endemic situation where this virus becomes part of our annual list of characters that come and visit us, such as influenza and respiratory syncytial virus or RSV. So I think this is just an acknowledgement that we have gotten through the worst, but we still have some challenges ahead.
So if it will become more endemic like influenza, every fall I go to get my flu vaccine, how will this change COVID-19 vaccines without this public health emergency, Dr. Tempty?
Well, it shouldn't change things very much.
Okay.
As many of the listeners are aware, these vaccines came through initially with what we called an emergency use authorization, which allowed the FDA to approve the vaccines through an accelerated pathway. However, the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine have now been fully licensed, meaning they've gone through the full usual FDA review. And so along that line, it's not going to change things very much at all. The other thing to keep in mind is that the vaccines that we have all received or have been recommended to receive have been provided free of charge. They've been covered by the federal government. The transition that's going to occur is the vaccines will start being covered by private insurers, by medical assistants, and by Medicare. And so that change will be relatively invisible to consumers and regular people out there, and more noted by the insurance industry.
Yeah, Pfizer and Moderna say their vaccines will cost between $82 and $130, which is somewhere about three or four times, as I understand it, what the government paid. So this could impact those without insurance then, maybe the hardest?
That's correct. In this country, any vaccine that is recommended by the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices has to be covered by insurers without any deductible. However, if you're one of those individuals who is totally uninsured, there really isn't any way to pay for it except out of your own pocket.
Dr. Tempty, how will this change COVID testing with an end to the public health emergency on COVID coming up in May?
Well, I think the major thing we're going to see is the change from being able to request free home tests or to get a home test that is entirely covered by your insurance company to one that you might have to shell out some money for. There might be a copay. You might have to pay the entire cost. What we have actually seen across the country is a rapid decline in the use of the PCR or polymerase chain reaction tests to the home tests or the rapid tests. And the difference between those two is the home tests, we don't have any mechanism to require people to report the results. So ever since we've made this transition to more and more home tests, we've become a little bit more blind to how much COVID is actually out there. But again, what we're finding is people are less and less inclined to test. We're finding that in general, as people have been vaccinated and as people have had prior infections, the cases become more and more mild and less of the type that people want to know what that result is. So I think this is a reasonable time to make this transition.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty, our guest, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we invite you to this conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have some concerns about the end of this emergency declaration coming up in May, or if you're wondering why we haven't declared an end to this emergency already, 1-800-642-1234 if you're in the healthcare sector. Also like to get your perspective this afternoon, and you can also email us ideas@WPR.org. So Dr. Tempty, why not end this emergency declaration now? The Republican-controlled House is looking to pass the Pandemic is Over Act, which would end, in essence, this emergency as soon as it would become law. Is there a reason we wouldn't end it now as opposed to May?
Well, I think across the media, you've heard more and more about having an appropriate exit ramp. And I think the thing that we really have to keep into account are the other things with this pandemic that the money and the declaration of an emergency has allowed money to flow. So for example, when the declaration of the end of this occurs, we're going to see a number of people may be removed from medical assistance, people that might earn a little bit too much but have been kept on because of pandemic funding. For individuals out there with student loans, there have been some people who have had kind of a pause on the repayment schedule. I think really important for a state like Wisconsin is the public health emergency allows hospitals to collect some additional money for individuals on Medicare who have COVID. And this has allowed many of our rural hospitals to keep their doors open and keep patient care going. And so there are a lot of things that we need some time for transitioning. I think one other area that we've learned to do, I know that in our clinic we do much more than we ever have before, is the telemedicine visit. And there has been a relaxation of the rules for telemedicine visits during the pandemic. And we need time to kind of adjust and, you know, make new processes so this continues to work into the future.
Let's go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Kay is standing by. Kay, good afternoon. You're on the air with Dr. Jonathan Tempty.
Hi. I'm wondering if the role of pharmacists is going to change at all, because now they give a lot of immunizations, and I wondered if that's going to change.
Great question, Kay, and thank you. Dr. Tempty?
That is a wonderful question. And in fact, pharmacists are allowed to provide virtually any vaccine, especially to adults. And so I don't see any change coming, particularly with COVID vaccines or with other vaccines. And over the years, we have evolved in the medical community to more and more embrace our colleagues in pharmacy as being really, really important people in terms of helping to get that vaccine out there. We have pharmacies open at well beyond the hours of most of our clinics. They're oftentimes more accessible. So this is one of those good things that I think is going to continue.
Good to hear. And we're talking with Dr. John Tempty, the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, with us to talk about the U.S. announcing the end of the COVID public health emergency, which will happen on May 11th. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. If you're in healthcare, what do you think of the end of the public health emergency? Would you like to see it sooner? Or would you like to see it extended? How are you planning on that changing your work or, for that matter, your personal life? 800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Dr. John Tempty, the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're looking at the announced end of the COVID-19 public health emergency, now set for May 11th. We invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think it's time to end this public health emergency for COVID-19? And what questions do you have about what will change? You can always email us as well, ideas@WPR.org. And Dr. Tempty, I wanted to ask, this end of the public health emergency has been pushed back a few times. Is there any reason to believe it could be or could be delayed again?
This has been a virus that has been fairly unpredictable. However, if we look at the tea leaves out there, being a coronavirus, if we look at our other coronaviruses that we see commonly in Wisconsin, they mostly go away after April or May, and we don't see them again until fall. So my gut sense is that we're going to see low levels of this virus continue on, but perhaps we'll catch a bit of a break during the summertime. So I think, to be honest, in terms of the timing being on May 11th, that's probably an ideal time. And I think we just have to keep our eyes open, keep surveillance systems going, keep our vigilance up to see what happens with this virus. And hopefully we don't see the emergence of a much more harmful virus or a variant out there. But we will be smarter as time goes on.
Let's continue with your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. Jack in Milwaukee, you're on the air with Dr. John Tempty.
Yeah, do you see any funding problem potentially with for the local health departments to continue their programs related to immunization of the disabled and the frail elderly, or even those on hospice who may fall through the cracks here? As I understand it, in my own experience, we actually got an elderly parent immunized through staff through a private charity, even though she was on Medicare, on hospice. You have any comments on that?
Jack, I very much appreciate that perspective. And Dr. Tempty, what do we know?
Well, that's really such an important area, Jack. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, Wisconsin ranks either 48th or 49th. In terms of public health funding going out to the counties. And people across their 72 counties, our public health officers, are just devastated from the last 3 years. There has been incredible turnover in terms of personnel. There have been workforce problems, you name it. And so going forward, you're absolutely correct that we will be understaffed, underfunded, and the ability to be able to meet in the homes or in community centers for people who don't have access to care elsewhere, this is a problem that's going to continue as long as we underfund our public health infrastructure and, more importantly, our public health personnel.
Dr. Tempty, what would change with the end of this public health emergency when it comes to mask wearing or other COVID safety protocols? Would any of those change?
Not really. The masking has always been the purview of either a state or a county, or sometimes there is a mandate put on by a school district. We have never had a federal mask mandate except for public transportation. And so I think going forward, we're unlikely to see any of that. And in fact, the experience has been so negative that I think going forward, people are going to be very, very reluctant, even if there is a legitimate purpose, but very reluctant to bring back any mask mandates.
Let's continue with your questions now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Dr. Jonathan Tempty. Chris in Elkhart Lake, good afternoon.
I was just wondering if once it's dropped down from the rate it's at, whether or not there's going to be mandatory injections or, you know, at works, schools, mostly workplace, that you have to actually be vaccinated to get keep your employment.
Yeah, I think going forward, Chris, that about the only place that you will likely see a mandate for becoming vaccinated for COVID is going to be within the medical profession, in healthcare settings, for physicians, for physician assistants, nurse practitioners, for nurses, medical assistants, laboratorians. But outside of that, I really find that very unlikely. In fact, we really don't have any national or statewide mandates for any vaccine outside of K through 12 educational settings. Going forward, I don't suspect we're going to see that. On the flip side, I'm just going to put a plug in that we know without any doubt that the vaccines have been incredibly effective in terms of prevention of death, of hospitalization, and of even if you do come down with COVID, they're effective for preventing long COVID. So there's so many good reasons to get these safe and effective vaccines that I don't think there's going to be any need to mandate.
Thank you, Dr. Tempty. And I do want to follow up with that and ask if with the end of this public health emergency coming May 11th, if there would be any other changes for doctors or nurses or others in the healthcare field.
Well, I think for healthcare settings, the rules are usually evaluated and set up by administrators, by infection control experts, and so on. And you have to keep in mind that in a healthcare setting, we're really responsible to keep those individuals who are coming in to see us and who have underlying medical problems, immunosuppression, and so on. It is our duty to keep them as safe as possible. And if I can prevent one of my patients from becoming ill from influenza or from COVID because maybe I have an infection, that's what I need to do. I need to have that ethical standpoint of protecting those people who are putting themselves at risk by coming to our clinic.
Dr. Tempty, what about Medicare enrollment, which we've seen increase during the pandemic? What would happen at the end of this public health emergency to those who have enrolled in Medicare in the last couple of years?
Well, I think people who enroll in Medicare are enrolling in Medicare either because they hit the appropriate age or because they have an underlying disability. And I don't see that enrollment changing at all. I think where we do see things changing is within the state-run medical assistance program, or Medicaid. And some of the rules for coverage have been relaxed during the declared emergency. And that relaxation may go away for some individuals with the end of the public health emergency.
Do we have a number on that? Because Health and Human Services, this was last August, said up to 15 million could be dropped from Medicaid rolls.
Yeah, that's the number I've actually seen quite recently as well. So across the country, it could be quite a number of people losing that Medicaid benefit and then having to go on to either the private market or one of the Affordable Care Act markets.
So, Dr. Temte, do we have any idea what the scope of this could mean for Wisconsin or what Medicaid enrollment might look like in Wisconsin after the public health emergency sunsets?
Yeah, I have not seen Wisconsin-specific numbers at this point in time, so I can't comment.
And moving forward, how do you think COVID should be treated in regard to policy and public policy and overall approach here?
Well, I think this is a virus that, even going back almost 3 years ago, you know, 2.5 years ago, I told people that I respected influenza, a virus that I've studied most of my career, and COVID scares me. Mm. And I haven't changed very much on that. As of this past Friday, the CDC indicated that maybe 17,000 people had died this entire influenza season, and we're just about done with influenza now. So 17,000 across the country, and that compares to, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 people dying each week in the United States of COVID. And that has been going on since the beginning. And I think we're going to unfortunately continue to see hundreds of deaths on a daily basis across this country for at least the foreseeable future. So I think going forward, we still have to have a great deal of respect of COVID with the knowledge that there are things that we can do to limit its danger.
Dr. Temte, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
And thank you so much for having me. Have a good day and keep healthy.
Dr. Jonathan Temte, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to take a look at the end of the public health emergency for COVID-19 coming up May 11th. Did a computer write this? Microsoft is investing billions in the artificial intelligence called ChatGPT. It can create new complex content from basic human input. Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported that the website BuzzFeed is planning to use a version of ChatGPT to write some of their content. ChatGPT has just passed an Ivy League MBA exam at the Wharton School of Business. Real estate agents are using ChatGPT to write their property listings. The first AI legal defense was scheduled for February in California until multiple state bar associations pointed out that ChatGPT doesn't have a law degree. ChatGPT has now written a speech given by a congressman on the U.S. House floor, and a Massachusetts state lawmakers used ChatGPT to draft a bill to regulate itself. I tried to get ChatGPT to write this, but sadly it was too busy with everybody else. But I did find some music written by Google's artificial intelligence. Yeah, this is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up tonight at 6 on 1A+, India's prime minister has been in power for nearly 9 years. Now he's in hot water after censoring a documentary about his role in a series of deadly riots. That's tonight on 1A+, India's future. Now, major media companies have gone through more rounds of layoffs in recent months, while smaller local news operations have struggled just to stay afloat. It's creating a challenging media environment that leads to less coverage and lower quality information for consumers. It has journalists and advocates alike concerned about the future, so a group of them are teaming up now to try and do something about it. The newly relaunched Rebuild Local News Coalition aims to develop new funding sources and push for policies to support independent, objective journalism to address the issues facing the industry. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What's the local news like in your town? What do you see and hear about what's going on where you're from? Do you wish there was more coverage of the issues in your area? And how would you like to see local journalism supported? What can we do? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Anna Brugman. She's the Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. And Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So for starters, who's all in this coalition?
So our coalition has nonprofit newsrooms represented by Institute for Nonprofit News, commercial digital-only sites, local independent online news publishers, weeklies, some dailies, rural weekly papers through a national newspaper association. It's a really broad coalition. There's Spanish-speaking publications and historic Black newspapers. Overall, there's 20-plus organizations that rebuild local news represents. And the idea is that we all work in concert together to advocate for public policies to support the future of the local press.
So what happened to the local press? Where did it all go? How did it lose its funding?
A long story, and it would honestly depend on where you began. I don't think we can start with the Industrial Revolution, but I'll start. We'll put in the 1990s, I guess. So the internet was obviously a huge disruptor to local news. And again, there's many great journalism historians that have much more sweeping local news histories than this one. But the internet was a massive disruptor to the business model of local news. It used to be that you would put your classified ads or advertisements into a local newspaper. And that became a platform for local businesses and even larger businesses to advertise to consumers. But it's not been that way for many, many decades. And that led to a slow and then very fast decline of local journalism. 2008, the recession was very hard on many local newspapers. That's not to say that there isn't innovation in the local news sector. I don't want to paint the whole picture. It's very bleak. There's tons of innovation happening. Something like 30% of nonprofit newsrooms didn't exist 5 years ago. There's business model innovation happening at local newspapers and commercial digital-only sites. But overall, we have almost 60% fewer local journalists than we used to. And that's really because of a stir up of the business model and also changes in reader habits. So again, I won't start at the Industrial Revolution, but...
but you could.
I won't.
Thank you, Anna.
You're so welcome.
One of the news stories that I've seen recently is about the Department of Justice's antitrust case against Google, saying that they've got a corner on the market of online advertising. Is that part of the problem for local journalism?
It is part of the problem for local journalism. Platforms and digital ad monopolies are part of the problem, but I think it's a piece of the problem, not all of the problem. Anytime you introduce new technology into journalism, there's a huge shift. There's a transition. This happened when we introduced television. Newspapers actually started doing more analysis when television was introduced because they were no longer the source for quick information. When radio entered the journalism market, there was a huge stirrup. There's always disruption anytime you introduce a new technology. And so to some extent that was to be expected. The way that Google and Facebook have colluded to corner the market on digital advertising is a problem, not just for local news outlets, but for small businesses generally. So that is, again, a piece of the problem, but I wouldn't say pin all the issue on that digital ad monopoly.
Anna Brugman, our guest, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. And so what are some of these issues that this coalition is looking to take on?
Of course. And so we're looking at public policies that incentivize the hiring of journalists. And so the policy that we've been attending to the most closely in the last few years is something called the payroll tax credit, which sounds like the least exciting piece of public policy I could possibly imagine. But it is a very exciting piece of public policy. what it does is it provides a refundable tax credit to local news outlets that is calculated based on how much you pay your local journalist. And so this money goes to the news outlets. It doesn't go to the local journalist. And there is a cap on how much local news outlets can get on these tax credits. It was singled out and put into Build Back Better. Obviously, Build Back Better didn't pass. It was also included in the end of year omnibus in 2022. It got cut at the last minute, but we've been working very closely with this policy at the federal level. But then there are a series of other ones that we've been looking at the state and local level, refundable tax credits for small businesses to advertise in local media. And when I say local media and local news outlets, I'm not just talking about newspapers. I've mentioned nonprofits. Public radio is a great example of local journalism that this would benefit. You're so welcome. Commercial digital onlys. I use local news outlets very broadly, but the refundable tax credit to small businesses would incentivize small businesses to take out advertising in local news outlets. There's another one for subscribers. We're looking at municipal advertising allocation. So every government, city, state, federal, has an advertising budget for many of its projects like the Department of Health or or your city's recreational department. There's an advertising budget. And much of that advertising budget, especially at the higher in government you go, doesn't go to local journalism. And so New York City tried a program where a certain proportion of some agencies' budgets had to be allocated to community newsrooms. Chicago just passed it as well. So we're also looking at scaling those sorts of programs. Those are the ones that have been introduced so far. We're also really interested in something called replanting, which would incentivize the purchase of newspapers from large chains into local hands. And so ideally that would be like a local trust or a public benefit corporation, incentivizing local ownership and disincentivizing non-local ownership. I will say that that small business tax credit that I talked to was actually introduced in Wisconsin last year and had, I believe, 16 co-sponsors. Representative Novak was the lead co-sponsor on that. And so it's not just, you know, the coastal states that are looking at this are states all around the United States that are interested in supporting their local press through public policy.
So how would you rebuild local news? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. What do you see in your local newspaper, or how about your local nonprofit news source that you'd like to give a shout out to and what we can do to support them? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas@WPR.org with our guest, Anna Brugman, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. So Anna, if we're going to offer these payroll tax credits or offer tax credits at all for these local information sources, you'd have to make a case for the value for the rest of us, or the value the rest of us would see in a robust local journalism. What's its value to me?
Oh boy, what a
I know.
Again, where to start? So I guess I could start by talking about what happens when local news leaves. And we've studied this mostly by looking at when local newspapers leave. For a very long time in our nation's history, local newspapers have provided kind of like the foundation of local news sources. So much of what gets up to national broadcast or national newspapers starts as a local story. And so local newspapers have for a long time provided the bedrock of not only accountability reporting, but also kind of the that social capital, those ties to community, the community features that remind people why they care about their community. People who read local news are more likely to volunteer. They're more likely to vote. They are more likely to take interest in a civic cause. And so you begin to appreciate what local news offers a community by studying what happens when something like a local newspaper leaves a community. And what we see is almost every metric by which you would measure civic health or the health of a community trends in the opposite direction as you would want when you lose local news in a community. And so that's voting rates. That's the number of folks running for an elected position. Incumbents are more likely to win elections when local news leaves. Polarization increases. There's a professor, I believe he's at LSU, Josh Darr, has done a lot of research on how local news affects polarization. Government borrowing rates go up. Bond ratings trend the wrong direction. Government waste goes up. I could go on and on and on and on. It's even more likely that communities without local news will have environmental disasters because there's fewer people watching corporate interests in those communities. And so there's fewer people who are able to point and say there is corporate malfeasance that could result in an environmental disaster. There have been some that have posited that it's more likely that infectious disease will spread without strong local news. It's almost every metric by which you would.
So you basically, would, yeah, what happens without local news? You have no idea.
And I think that there's I'm going to say his last name wrong. And if he's listening, I'm sorry, Tony. He's a publisher in Iowa. He wrote a paper after he graduated from a program called New Start in West Virginia. And he wrote that it's really hard to know which direction local news works in, whether it's a cause or an effect, but it is wrapped up into the economic health of a community. And so it's the economy, it's the government, it's civic life, it's pollution, it's health. I think a good way to think about it is like, when is the last time you cared about something in your community? When is the last time you were upset about something or found yourself feeling really proud of your community? And where did you read it? Where did you hear about it? And I'd be willing to bet a lot of money. but I'm a journalist, so I don't have that much money.
So not a lot to wager on that. We're talking with Anna Brugman from Rebuild Local News Coalition about the state of local journalism and efforts to support it. What would you do? 1-800-642-1234. What would you like to see? 1-800-642-1234. Or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Anna Brugman. She's the Public Policy Director for the Rebuild Local News Coalition with us today to talk about the challenges facing local journalism outlets and some potential solutions. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Would you pay for more local news if a tax credit was available for it? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Anna, Tom in Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know if there's any relationship between your organization and public broadcasting or just print media. What are some of the groups that are part of this coalition?
Well, hi, Tom in Milwaukee. We work very closely with public media. National Public Broadcasting isn't a member of the coalition, but we work very closely together. And we make sure that any policy that we are advocating for is what we call platform neutral or medium agnostic, which means that as long as folks hire local reporters, as long as you're transparent about your ownership, and as long as you're not owned or majority funded by organizations likely to have political motives, and you're probably local journalism, and you should probably be supported with any public policy. And so that's public radio, that's print, that's nonprofits, that's commercial digital onlys. We really are focused on the local journalism and who is likely to do that local journalism more than just the medium at hand.
And is there a name for the federal legislation for a payroll tax credit for media outlets?
So that was originally proposed in something called the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, which was introduced in 2021 for the second time. It is bipartisan in the House. It has a pretty broad spectrum of co-sponsors on that. And so if you look at the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, there are three pillars, which one is the payroll tax credit, one is the advertising tax credit, and one is the subscription tax credit. And so the payroll tax credit was singled out in Build Back Better, but was originally introduced as that big bundle of policies.
And Anna, if I'm a news devourer, not just a news consumer, but I just can't get enough, what more can I do to support the information, to get more information? What role do I play in this?
And so if there is a high quality news outlet in your area, support it, whether that be your public radio station, your local newspaper, your local nonprofit. I subscribe to a combination of all of those. And then you can support organizations that are trying to help other local news outlets. And so that's folks like American Journalism Project or Report for America, which our founder, Stephen Waldman, also helped found. American Journalism Project is in venture philanthropy. It's a very innovative organization that's working to kind of shore up the business side of local news outlets. Many of our members, in fact, do take donations, and they would be very excited to see more donors supporting their work of supporting local journalism. Report for America is a really interesting, full disclosure, did work for them for a little bit, organization that places local journalists in local newsrooms that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford them, kind of similar to like Teach for America or AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps, but for local journalists in the United States. And so you can look for these organizations if you're looking for a way to do even more than just subscribe to your local news outlets that you feel provide high quality journalism for your community. You could look at those organizations to support as well.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Pat in Green Bay is standing by. Pat, good afternoon. You're on the air with Anna Brugman, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my phone call. I'm all for this public support. I don't know. I'm sorry, your person that you're talking to, I can't keep up with her. She's very, very quick. But anyway, all I want to say is, you know, it's all good, but we need to do away with where we have one news source that's slanted towards the Democrats, one that's slanted towards the Republicans. That shouldn't have anything to do with the news. The news should be the news, not what corporate America wants us to see.
So how do we keep the partisan away from the information when it comes to journalism, Anna?
That's a great question. And I am sorry, I speak very quickly. I'll try to slow it down a bit. The qualifying language in a lot of the public policies that we're pushing, it does not have anything to do with the content that is produced. And so in terms of how public policy could enhance a perceived partisanship, we are actively, that is a pillar of our approach to pursuing public policy, is making sure that's not the case, is that no government official would be able to pick and choose which newspaper or news outlet would benefit from a specific policy. And we do that by constructing qualifying language that is more about the characteristics of a newspaper or a news website or a public radio station. Do you hire journalists? Do they live in the area in which they cover? Are they not funded by politically motivated folks? In terms of the journalism that is done, the public policy is actually, we intentionally distant from that because it would be a nightmare to us as journalists to pass policies that undermine the independence of the local press. That's our worst case scenario. And so I think that it's important to have conversations with your local newspaper and local journalists. Local journalists are people. I've been a little local journalist before. we're humans. And we would love to have a discussion with the folks that we cover about how we can improve our coverage. I think part of that is what happens in the conversations we have with local journalists and our local newspapers, and our role in that is making sure that we have sustainable and thriving and vibrant local news outlets in all communities that can cover be a voice for the community. So I think that's our role in it.
And we've just got about a minute left here, Anna, but how would you respond to concerns people might have about the government being involved with regulating journalism or funding it?
Yeah, I think that's a real fear. And I think we don't want to disqualify that at all. And as I said, a major pillar of our policy pursuits is that they're content neutral, that we don't pass policies that put a government official in the position of picking which publications serve their interests. And we don't want journalism that serves government interests. As I said, the qualifying language, the definitions, the qualifying language, the really, really boring, wonky stuff is really, really important in these policies. And we think it's a huge responsibility to pass good journalism policy because we need more good journalism.
Yeah, the really, really boring stuff, which is what you do at the Rebuild Local News Coalition.
But we do.
Hey, Anna, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Brugman is the Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. She was with us today to discuss efforts to revitalize local journalism through its advocacy. A note of clarity here, Wisconsin Public Radio is not part of the Rebuild Local News organization. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Rob Ferret returns with a look at what it takes to help refugees find a home here in the U.S. Meet the president and COO of the Welcome Corps. And you don't need to study harder or study more. You just need to study smarter. The author of Study Like a Champ joins Rob Ferret tomorrow. Coming up after the news, from jobs to exercise to school, we're using games, points, and streaks as motivation. And that isn't always a good idea, according to our next guest, the author of the new book, You've Been Played. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.